Welcome to Who Knew? We are fans of the current series of Doctor Who, and here we discuss our likes, dislikes, and insights into the modern regeneration of this show. Subscribe, review, and listen to us on iTunes and Stitcher, or our YouTube channel, youtube.com/WhoKnewPodcast. All our episodes are on WhoKnewPodcast.com. You can leave comments there, or email us at WhoKnewPodcast@gmail.com. We also have an Instagram and Twitter account. Tweet at us at WhoKnewPodcast, and find us on Facebook.
Today we're taking a quick trip in the TARDIS with Classic Who.
Today it's Who Classic.
Today's episode is The Deadly Assassin. It's the third serial of the 14th season. This story features Tom Baker as the fourth Doctor and no companion. The Doctor returns to Gallifrey, but will he end up as a prisoner or the president? This episode is written by Robert Holmes, directed by David Maloney. It originally aired between the 30th of October through the 20th of November, 1976. The second part got the highest ratings of 12.1 million viewers. Hi, this is Eugene. Let's introduce ourselves.
Hi, this is Frank.
This is Kelsey.
Hi, this is Josh.
Hello, this is Auburn.
And this is Brian.
In the TARDIS, the Doctor has a vision of an assassination on Gallifrey. He travels to the planet where it's Presidential Resignation Day. The Time Lords want to arrest him as a criminal, but he needs to get to the President to warn him. With a clever deception, he eludes the guards and later witnesses a cloaked figure kill a guard. The Time Lord authorities piece together the Doctor's history and discover he's a member of the Prydonian chapter, one of the highest social chapters on Gallifrey. The Castellan, Spandrel, goes to report this information to Chancellor Goth. Observed only by the cloaked figure, the Doctor sneaks back into the TARDIS.
A clever deception?
Yes. By Constantinople. I will use my hookah.
So the hookah, the hat, yeah. Facing the other way, just has it all piled up. But the hookah was good to add smoke, so they really thought somebody was there smoking.
It was clever, and it worked.
And they ordered the fog machine, so they had to get their work out of it.
Now, in the dream, or whatever you want to call it, the mental precognition that he had, he saw himself. It seemed like he killed him. Right.
That's how I took it.
Where he shot the president.
Yeah. Right.
But he didn't shoot the deputy. Totally freaked out by it.
What's that?
No. He shot the president, but he did not shoot the deputy.
There's no grassy knoll or anything.
Here we get an opening crawl.
Like Star Wars.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And was that read by Tom Baker?
Was that it? Yeah. And this is Tom, like I mentioned, this is Tom Baker by himself. He had just lost Sarah Jane in the previous story, The Hand of Fear.
Kind of kicked her out, but
that's helpful because I was wondering why he was companionless.
Yeah,
and that's why she could not come with him on this trip. He had to go back to Gallifrey because of this. So that's why he says, you know, you have to go. You have to get out of here.
He gets a weird crash zoom in, zoom out message. Gallifrey is calling me, and then he goes, "Oh, I can't take Sarah Jane with me." And then this is it. This is why.
Yeah, aliens aren't allowed on Gallifrey at this time.
And
racist.
Also,
oh,
xenophobic. That's not topical at all. And we also get, I think our group gets the first look into this like woodworky console room.
This is the TARDIS auxiliary room.
This is the first time I've ever seen it.
The first time we've seen it, yes. Yeah. But it was first introduced in The Mask of Mandragora in 1976 as well.
It's not the main console room.
Oh,
that's
really?
How they explain it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
What happened?
I love the woodwork and the stained
glass. Oh, I think it was great. So have they seen a main console room then?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have that octagonal or whatever.
It does.
Centerpiece?
It does.
Oh, this is just sort of
I mean, the fourth Doctor also has a normal console room just like the other classic Doctors. But for some reason, I don't know the episode where this was introduced, they had to use the auxiliary.
Well, what happened, I'll recap that briefly. Sarah Jane and him are walking through the TARDIS. It's a bad special effect with a... It looks like green screen. But she goes, "What's in there?" "Oh, that's the wardrobe. That's nothing." And then they keep going. And then he sees this. "Oh, I haven't used this in a while. Let's see, she's just use this." And then that's where they stuck.
You know, with all the wood paneling, it does look very different. But you see there's no moving parts in there. I mean, it does have a view screen.
The other one.
But it doesn't have the center column thing.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, it's probably the view screen then. Because they've never used that before, had they?
Oh, they have.
Oh, yeah.
Had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the little light panels are pretty cheap. Like, I think you noticed, Kelsey, that you press one button and
the whole row.
Yeah.
I think they use this one for this episode to give the Doctor an out. Because we know that the main console room is right at the door. Everybody comes in from the door and he's right there. So they had to get to this other room so that when they're all looking at the fake scarecrow of the doctor type of thing, he's in the background sneaking out.
Okay.
Otherwise, there's no way to get past the door.
Plus, also, they needed this console room because the console itself, one of the sides, is a secretary that contains the pen,
paper and pen and
everything, so you could just pull out it and he can write his note and then close it back up like a desk.
It does look very desk-like with all the wood.
Yeah.
A secretary is a small desk that
brings down. Okay.
Not an actual person.
Oh, okay.
I just had that look you had was, why is he saying secretary? You know, it's an old-fashioned desk.
Yeah, I found the opening of this very confusing, but the precognition, I didn't understand that that was what was happening. I thought maybe someone had taken possession of the doctor's body, and because they started with a weird fisheye lens, I think.
Yes.
And he seemed like he was out of control of his own, like, what he was doing, which was assassinating someone. And then, especially when they were trying to arrest him, I thought they were trying to arrest him because he had just murdered the president. Why were they trying to arrest him? Just because his TARDIS was there illegally or something?
Well, they're trying to figure out who he is, and this is an unregistered TARDIS.
Okay, yeah.
Then they go, why is there an unregistered TARDIS? Mm-hmm. Oh, look, this guy is a criminal. We've punished him before. And that was back when the second Doctor wound up on Gallifrey and was banished to Earth, forced to regenerate into the third Doctor, and they took the TARDIS powers away.
They didn't know who he was. It's just that this is a no parking zone. The TARDIS is in a loading or unloading TARDIS zone. So it was like, it just showed up. It's not registered like it should be.
Yeah, they ran the plates and they're like, he's got a couple of outstanding tickets. Yeah.
Especially on an inaugural day.
So they didn't know who was inside, and then they found out, you know, later on that
he was a known criminal. But he wasn't wanted for anything at that time because they had already punished him
by his exile. Banishing him to Earth.
But showing up the way he did, they're like, oh, he's back at his criminal ways. So
okay. But for me, just thrown into this episode, it was confusing. But I had faith that all would be explained when I arrived here today.
It was confusing. It was. I agree with you. The whole episode did seem confusing.
Yeah, that's sort of the style. I don't want to call it the style. I just think it's the way that they make the show is they just have stuff happen. Hey, this is a new trick with the camera. Oh, what if we do this? And like, well, how are people going to understand that? They'll get it at some point. And they just do it.
The first 15 minutes of every serial of Classic Who, you're just going, you guys just threw us in this, didn't you?
Like you just said, we're a beat behind. But that makes me... That's the one thing about watching these classic episodes that where at first I think, I'm not going to enjoy this. But I always, halfway through, I'm like, I'm actually quite engaged. And I think that's why, because it kind of constantly leaves you in a state of confusion where you're like, what is going on? And by the time you figure out what's going on, something else is posed. They're like, wait, what is that? So you just kind of keep going into the end like, wait, what?
Plus a cliffhanger every 22 minutes.
And there's
minutes.
Always a cliffhanger. Yeah.
But one of the things that was very confusing for me was the Doctor's never been clairvoyant. And so why does he see the future of himself?
Yeah, but you find out later.
Which I'm glad they did address. Since we're not watching it at that time period again, or watching it in contents.
It's like the power to fall from great heights through a glass ceiling.
Exactly.
I liked when the Gallifreyans were talking about the TARDIS, you know, they kept saying, oh, it's a really old model. Like, I love world building stuff like that.
Yeah.
But that being said, being more in the new Doctor Who adventures, like by the end of this serial, thinking about the timelines for everything, I was like, do they all fit together with what we think today? But I don't think that's very important. Or do they?
No. Going off of what you said, this is the first time that the Gallifreyans and Time Lords have looked this way.
And by look this way, do you mean like all old?
John.
Oh. Or with the costumes?
With the costumes, the robes and the...
And the
headdresses.
Back head pieces?
Yes.
Oh.
Because Robert Holmes, who wrote this episode, he changed the Time Lords to be more parliamentary and House of Lords. Where previously Barry Letts was the head story guy, he was the Time Lords were done more like Eastern mystical.
Hmm. And then I remember the other Time Lord we saw
was like a butler.
Had like a bowler hat and
he
like
was a banker.
Yeah,
like Patrick McGee from the Avengers.
Mm-hmm. Was that just like a costume while he was traveling, or was that just another kind of look that might have been in
the
somebody's idea?
Suit. Yeah, I think that gets retrofitted into mm-hmm. what you want it to be. It's just something interesting when mm-hmm. they were making it.
Or he wanted to fit to look like he was from, you know, America, from.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like,
so,
was that like?
So when he is hanging hundreds of feet
right.
above the.
That's normal.
Air.
Well,
he looks human,
like Mary Poppins.
But anyway, this version, like we did Genesis of the Daleks, this version of what Time Lords and Gallifreyans look like stuck. Mm-hmm. This was like
yeah,
canon yeah. now.
Definitely. I gotta say, despite some of the technological, you know, costume drawbacks of the day, like some of the stuff was cardboard backed and stuff. Like very, I thought it was a very nice job. Like those helmets were obviously rubber molds, but they were good rubber molds. And back in the 70s, nobody knew what rubber like that sculpted rubber with texture really looked like. So I'm sure it looked pretty fancy.
And there was a lot of costumes and characters
yeah.
and yeah,
it definitely,
all alien.
Like you said, world building. It definitely felt like its own world. And when mm-hmm. they, you know, later on talk about the different types of robes and the colors and things like that.
Yeah. I think this is the point where they talk about it, but the Castellan and the coordinator.
Egan.
Yes. They talk about the CIA.
Yeah.
Which is the Celestial Intervention Agency.
Yeah.
Those ruthless and determined people. How could he be CIA?
Is a Castellan a word from another, like, a culture of ours, or is that a made-up word for Gallifrey?
No, I think it's a real world.
Yeah.
That's a title, though.
Someone in charge of the castle, right? Or
oh,
manor?
A castle or the land?
Yeah. Well,
I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
That's a bad joke.
But like yeah, a house, like yeah. a manor,
so
like that kind of idea.
It is an existing
idea,
word for us pre-Doctor Who.
The governor of a castle.
Yeah, the British would know it better than.
Ah, there you go.
It's funny because right now they're like melding American and European things together, like Castellan and then CIA is, you know, for mm-hmm. Central Intelligence Agency.
Well, and having cardinals in the government.
Yeah. And then later
and then
on
a president.
And then later on a constitution, which
probably
is
probably presidents yeah. of companies.
Well, yeah, but this is government.
But not heads of state right. in
but,
government.
But then, yeah. and then the interesting thing later, you discover that the president has no power, and it's like, okay, there are European countries like that where they have a president mm-hmm. who does like all the ceremonial head of state stuff, and then they have the prime minister is actually the head of the
government. Yeah.
Goth and Spandrel discuss whether the Doctor is a threat to the President. They go to see the Doctor's old-style TARDIS. Inside, the Doctor is watching the news broadcast of the impending presidential succession. The reporter, Runcible, is an old schoolmate of the Doctor's. He's trying to interview Cardinal Barossa, their former academy teacher, but is brushed off rudely. Goth orders the TARDIS moved into the capital. The Doctor emerges and decides to go to the Panopticon, where the ceremony is taking place. He takes a set of Gallifreyan robes that are nearby.
But Pandorica will open.
I like the whole reporter bit. I felt that was a nice modern take, contemporary take placed into this world. But to leave his clothes there when he purposely takes clothes to hide himself.
But how are we supposed to know that he has changed unless he leaves his old clothes?
All right. Could easily have panned to his clothes being hidden under the seat.
Yeah.
Well, it is a museum, so something needs to be hanging there. And if people aren't paying attention, they say, okay, something's there,
oh,
rather than seeing an empty spot.
That was always the piece that I missed. It was like, isn't it convenient that there are robes right outside the TARDIS?
I just thought it was like a cloak closet or...
No, you hear later that they moved the TARDIS into a museum.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
So that's why you've got these formal robes. It's a museum display.
Right.
I thought it was just kind of like, wow.
It's also, I think, a good, you know, character part of the Doctor, because the Fourth Doctor would do that. I mean, it's just having fun with it.
Yeah.
It's a Fourth Doctor
yeah,
move.
I do like that element of it, but just the logic of it was just moot.
Also, by the way, Panopticon is not a made-up word for Doctor Who. It is a type of institutional building and a system of control designed by the English philosopher Jeremy Bentham in the late 18th century. Design is to allow all, Pan, inmates of an institution to be observed, opticon, by a single watchman, without the inmates being able to tell whether or not they are being watched.
And that's the big room where the big ceremony and the...
Mm-hmm. Okay. A couple of lines here that I like, where the Time Lords are dressing are in their gowns before the doctor grabs them. He says, like, fellows nowadays chomping and changing every couple centuries. It's just like more world building, like these youngins, they're just changing and regenerating willy-nilly.
I remember that president who lasted 900 years. Now there was a president.
Yeah. I'm like, okay. And then when Runcible is talking to Tom Baker, he says, have you had a facelift?
Several.
Yeah. So I mean, I like that they're like,
that is funny, that thing. How he recognized him right away as a schoolmate.
Tyvelers kind of have that ability to know who it is.
Yeah. They can sense who someone is.
It's kind of like a Jedi presence I haven't felt since.
Since what? And I do like how he looked at the doctor and said, weren't you expelled?
Right.
Or, yeah. Something happened. And so it just starts adding to the mystery.
Well,
it's
funny how the doctor always comes into a new situation and everyone's like, who is this crazy person who seems to know everything? And this guy's just like, oh, it's you.
But he's still the smartest person in the room, like wherever he goes.
I did feel in this episode that the lack of budget didn't affect the visuals all that much compared to things in the past. I think the costumes, like we said, were pretty good for the time, and then they didn't really try to do all that much special effects wise that was all that crazy. Nothing really stood out to me now that I'm thinking about it.
Well, and
except from the video effects.
Those
were just of the time.
And I mean, I did like some of those that come later, the effects, and I'll talk about it when we get to those, but I mean, a lot of this serial was based in like very physical locations, mm-hmm. and like you didn't have laser guns, you had a regular gun, mm-hmm. you know?
And even the laser bolts were basic. Yeah. You know, they would happen so fast that anything fake you didn't really see.
Mm-hmm. I like the design of what they call a staser. Mm-hmm. It's like a clear glass. Mm-hmm. It's just very, to me, alien, and I like that design that I don't think stuck around, but it's very cool. And I like the design of the panopticon with the, it almost looks like jade krypton. Mm-hmm. It's like green ice crystals. Mm-hmm. But the production designer is Roger Murray Leach, and he had previously worked on Ark in Space. So he designed the Ark, and then they wanted him back for this.
I mean, that I think had more problems in it, but that was also, they were kind of reaching for beyond the scope. This is the bubble wrap alien episode, which, of course, bubble wrap looked amazing back then. I could see that, because they really stretched that episode for as much as they could.
The cloaked figure is reporting to his master that all is going as planned. The decayed figure says that the doctor must die very quickly. Spandrel and the guards return to the TARDIS to see if he has returned, but discover that a set of high-ranking robes are missing. They also find out that someone has recently accessed the doctor's records. On the balcony of the Panopticon, the news cameraman is attacked by the cloaked figure, who then points a staser rifle at the gallery. Now dressed in orange robes, the doctor is wandering around the crowd and realizes that the assassin is on the balcony. He runs to investigate while the president enters the Panopticon. The doctor finds the staser, aims it at the president, and fires, shooting the president in the chest. The president is dead, and the doctor is quickly captured.
And that must be our first...
That's the cliffhanger?
Yeah, first cliffhanger.
Part one?
Yeah, it was a surprise. I mean, obviously we find out the way it was revealed that it's different, but I was very surprised to see he didn't stop whatever he, it just happened, or... And then I also got a kick out of, like, well, history, the future is pre-written anyway, so...
This part reminded me of earlier, a line from Castellan Spandrel. He shot one of my guards. I see. Such efficiency. Lines like that just made me chuckle.
He can't stand that guy.
Yeah.
And he's the entire time he's just saying, you're incompetent at your job.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, you're really efficient, aren't you? You knew that we have a TARDIS here. We have a guy who's known to be a criminal. You let him go. You let him kill. Oh, wow, you're an efficient guy.
There's a quick little thing here that I have never caught before until we were watching this last night. The president has a line before he comes out. The guy says, are you all ready? And he says yes, and he holds up a scroll and he says, I've got the honors list. This is going to shock a lot of people. And a lot of American audiences might not know what that means, because the honors list they do twice a year in Britain, and that's the list that says this person's going to become a knight, this person's going to become a lord, this person's going to receive this honor or that honor. So it's called the honors lists. So for him to say, I have the honors list and it's going to surprise a lot of people, that's a foreshadowing that the person that we think he's going to name president won't be named president. And I never caught that before until last night. So it's like, oh, they are giving, if you knew what it meant, it's a little bit of foreshadowing of things aren't going to go well from the president's point of view, too.
I caught that, but I thought it was bad writing because I was confused later on when we find out what we find out. I thought, like, well, wasn't that list that he had a bunch of names? Because he said a lot of these names. So I thought, like, why did he say a lot of these names if it was just his successor?
I'm assuming that he was going to do a lot of, there was right. going to be a full list, plus my successor is this.
Right, but yeah. I think because it's a British show, they didn't explain it.
They didn't, because they don't need to.
Right, so I still got the context of it, but I didn't understand the expansion of what it was.
I also love the fact that, so you're telling me that you have the name of your successor on your scroll?
And no one picks it up.
Next to your body?
Right.
Hello?
Oh, did they mention that? Did they mention that?
No, it's never mentioned again.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe it stays theorized in the assassination.
I was confused, and afterwards, you know, when you find out everything going on in this episode, I was a little upset that they showed him shooting and the crosshair type of target is on the president. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't have shown that at this point. I know they did it for a cliffhanger effect. I know they did it in a kid's show. This is showing that he's killing the president. Yeah. But I don't think that shot with the crosshair should have been shown. Just because it didn't back up everything else going on in the story. That scene should have been taken out or shot differently.
Right, like when we find out later, we can't go back to that scene and it doesn't track.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, but it is a good, I think it is the best cliffhanger of the series. So I would have tuned in the next week just to find out, like, why did the doctor do that?
And
he went there to stop that.
Because there was a split second shot of a hand with another gun.
But I didn't catch that.
I didn't either until last night for the first time.
It wasn't in this episode. It was in the recap.
It's in the recap.
Yeah.
The beginning of the next episode.
We're going to show you.
Which I skip.
Well, it wasn't really a recap. It wasn't really a recap. It wasn't really, they reshot that same little scene. Or re-edited that same little scene.
No,
with a little extra information.
I always skip, though, because I assume it's the exact same. I always assume that it's the last 30 seconds of the previous show. So I just, like, skip it.
But that's old serial type of thing.
You're giving vital information that they don't give you during the cliffhanger because then it wouldn't be a cliffhanger.
I mean, that goes back to Buster Keaton and the old serials. Oh,
yeah. The reveal of the decomposed person was not the best costume that I've ever seen. I think this is the first time we see their face.
Skeletor?
Yeah.
Oh, you mean the master?
Yeah. Who will later...
No, it's the master at this point.
Oh, I think we can kind of wink-wink nod get that away.
But, I mean, for me watching, I could not tell who was talking because the lips weren't moving.
Yeah.
There weren't lips. There were no lips.
Yes.
There's a place for it, but...
And even, like, the teeth weren't really, like, moving properly at all.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. But I wonder what that looked like on regular television. That would have been really scary.
Yeah, it was definitely scary.
Yeah.
But I couldn't tell like that was where I should be paying attention.
Well, it was also a little confusing that the other person was also wearing a cloak.
Yes.
Albeit you're not as ragged, but
the close-up of the eye. The eyeball.
Yeah.
The doctor will die. And you're just like right in the eyeball. It's like you knew you had terrible, terrible makeup, but you're using it to full effect.
Yeah, so is this the first time we see him like that?
Yes.
And was he defeated in some way previously that he would...
No, actually, it's a real-world reason. The actor who played the master was killed in a car accident 2 years earlier.
Okay. Is it Roger Delgado?
I think it's Roger Delgado, yeah. And then, so they wrote this to be... He's run out of regenerations and he's withering away.
Right.
This was the first explanation of running out of regenerations and what that could possibly cause. Yeah. It's not the last time that we'll see the master very decayed like this, but when you see him again, the makeup, while still not great, is much, much better. Much better. His mouth actually moves. I mean, not to give spoilers away, but the next time that we see the master, he's in a decayed body and he absorbs another person's body, and that actor goes on to be the master for the remainder of the classic series.
Yeah. Spoilers from 70s, 80s.
Yeah.
And that's
Legopolis?
Yeah, it's Legopolis, where Tom Baker regenerates into Peter Davison. I wanted to point out that the room that Castellan Spandrel and Egan are in, I kind of like the design, even though it doesn't look... It's of its time, because I like that there's windows into like some sort of spacey thing, and then the computer panels have all lights. I don't know, I just really enjoyed seeing them in that like control tower or central data collector. I don't know what it is, but I enjoyed it.
I was pretty impressed with all of the elderly actors handling the sci-fi lingo. Yeah. Like, I felt like they knew what they were talking about. Like, because there's been other episodes where you're watching and you're like, they have no idea what they're saying. But even the fellow, the Castellan, who had a heavy accent, like, I was like, no, he knows what he's talking about. Like, I don't know if it was good direction or whatever, but... And I almost felt like some of the more cadre fellas were... Like, they looked like stage act. Like, they're doing their job. He knows exactly what he's talking about. And it's sci-fi jargon. And I was very impressed with that. Because back then, these people never heard that type of stuff. I thought they did a pretty good job. And at first, I thought the Castellan was a terrible actor. But as he was going on, I'm like, no, he's actually quite good.
Yeah, he's my favorite. Yeah, I love that character.
He's loved the less is more school of acting.
Yeah. And like, but I also just like the character in that this is the one character that only cares about facts.
Right.
So he doesn't, it doesn't matter who is telling him something.
Right.
He just needs, you know.
And I like how he starts off seeming like the antagonist and, ends up on the doctor's side.
Castellan is the detective guy?
Yeah.
Yeah,
the one with the accent.
The one with the
Italian accent.
Italian accent.
Oh, was that Italian? I knew it was an accent. I couldn't place it.
But I was just thinking, oh, wait, everybody's got a British accent.
Except him.
Without a named successor, Gallifrey could quickly devolve into chaos, so Goth immediately orders a trial. The guard commander, Hildred, is attempting to torture a confession out of the doctor. Spandrel orders the torture stopped and tells the doctor that he is to be vaporized in a few hours' time. The doctor states that he was framed. He was trying to save the president and tells the Castellan about his vision of the assassination. In the records room, Engen says there is no evidence that someone viewed the doctor's records. It would be nearly impossible to cover up.
I'm sorry. Question, who's Spandrel?
Castellan, the Italian.
The one we were just
talking about. Oh, so he's, his race is Castellan?
His title. No, his title.
We talked about that earlier, but he's the head of, because we...
His name is Spandrel.
Oh, okay.
I like this effect shot. I thought it was impressive for the day where the cell is hanging.
Yeah.
It's a matte shot. It's obviously a matte shot.
Yeah, but it was well done.
I'm like, cool, they're doing that. And then the line that the doctor says is vaporization without representation. I'm like, whoa, okay.
Yeah, I could get that.
And so Spandrel has the brown hat and Egan has the black helmet looking thing.
Same
Egan's
color,
older. Maybe. And he's the one who has the key.
That's correct.
He's the one who's the scientist. He's the scientist who's controlling the keyboard and the matrix, which we'll get into later. And, he's the one that's doing all the science. He's the science officer, I guess, or head of science.
He's definitely, he feels more feeble in his delivery, where Castellan Spandrel is more present. I don't know how else to explain.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just part of the character. Yeah. A man of science doesn't need to, we're not all... It's not like today where Chris Pratt is also the science officer.
Yeah. I think it's kind of funny when they're arguing, no, precognition is not possible, it's not possible, it's not possible. Allow me to show you my machine that tells what the future is going to happen. Mm-hmm. By the way, here are all our time machines that can go into the future and let you know what happens in the future. But precognition, that's crazy.
I did one of the things that I found odd, just he's never like handcuffed. He's never restrained. He's just kind of even in the court. Have we talked about the court yet? But even like in the courtroom, he's just sitting there. It just for me as an American, and I'm used to people who are arrested for murder,
for assassinating the president.
Usually don't just get to walk around freely.
Well, the British are all about manners.
They are gentlemen after all.
They're time lords.
Right.
Maybe he was time locked. We don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I think these older episodes have a real habit of just making, well, what we say is what's going on. You can't get away.
Yeah.
I can't get away.
Yeah.
But doesn't he also say to... Hold on one second. Doesn't he also say to Spandrel, I want to convince you?
Yeah.
And Spandrel agrees?
Yeah.
And that's in the cell. Isn't that in the mm-hmm. cell? So at that point...
Yeah.
Spandrel is, okay, you're going to be with me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's yeah. he's in charge. He looks yeah. a little older, but, you know, he could take him. What's he going to do? Give him to Hindrel, who can't hold anybody and he thinks is incompetent?
He's efficient. The trial starts. Goth really wants a quick guilty verdict. As his defense, the doctor invokes Article 17 of the Constitution and announces that he is a candidate for the presidency, thereby granting him protection from prosecution.
Just like in America.
A brief argument ends with the Time Lord saying that this is his right. Spandrel gives him 48 hours before the sentence is carried out. They examine the Staser and discover its sights are completely off, so the doctor could not have shot the president. He had seen the assassin in the group surrounding the president and attempted to shoot at him, but with the bad sights, he missed. He said the camera on the balcony must have recorded the whole thing.
But that's the point. He should have been aiming at the assassin. And so the target...
Crosshairs?
The crosshair should have shown him mm-hmm. towards the assassin rather than at the president.
Well, and then if the sights were off, he might have hit the president. How does he
I
know?
I thought that too, but I thought maybe it was so off yeah. that it was...
No, it's just that he doesn't have the responsibility since the sights were off.
Okay.
You know, yeah.
Which goes along with the rest of the story that if he was there to assassinate, he would have had his own gun lined up correctly.
Or have a gun that only he knew how to shoot to assassinate.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, if you know how far off it was. Yeah. That's the thing, the points that never come up. Well, what makes it so it's not possible you could have, knocked the gun off kilter after you shot him?
And that's us in our, law and order CSI mindset now.
And also this points out a very clear change between the classic show and much of the modern show is the doctor is using a gun.
Yeah. Well, that happened. There's a lot of things like that in this this story
arc. It's not the only time he uses a gun, but it is. He's just casually picking up and shooting a guy.
Yeah.
He's not like saying, duck! He's,
I did like that Article 17 was not meant for this purpose, but that it was any candidate for president has the ability to run and not be hindered.
Right.
So it's to try and protect the sanctity, of the democracy.
I thought it was quite clever.
So I like that he was able to then switch that around just to give him extra time because it's better than 3 hours, the 48 mm-hmm. hours. So
I kept expecting him to say Article 17 of the Shadow Plog Proclamation.
Yeah, and then looking back, I can appreciate now the doctor being unrestrained, standing at the table by himself, just doodling while everyone is talking, wasting their breath, because he knows that he has this card up his sleeve that he's about to play.
Also, he knows that the trial's a joke anyway.
Right, yeah.
It's both. He is mm-hmm. just like, well, I'm,
I mean, the way it was staged just seemed odd. Going, next, stand up and say what you want to say about it. Next.
But it's total show trial.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Where it was just kind of like, you just said something that doesn't match what we want. Don't you think it could have been this?
Right.
Yeah. No, you're right. That fellow who changed his story on the trial was an older fellow.
Old.
Is that the one where they're questioning his hearing?
Yes.
And then he goes, oh, but my hip. Do you remember that?
I mean, that was kind of sad. I think it could be played up a lot more now.
Yeah. I missed all of that.
Yeah, because they were...
He's giving testimony that the doctor says, the president could be shot.
He says, you have to help me. They'll kill him. And he says, couldn't your hearing be bad that they said, you have to help me, I'll kill him?
Yeah, and then to me, it's like he's deflecting, going, oh, but my hip. It's just weird.
No, it's just that he is old. It's
I know.
Could be. I mean, the possibility, because he, at that point, is saying things are possible.
Yeah.
He's not going whether or not it's probable.
I just found it funny
that
he kind of switched subjects from his hearing to his hip.
So I missed all of that stuff that you guys are talking about.
I want to know how much those drawings would go today.
They probably don't even exist.
They're probably thrown away.
Oh, yeah.
Who actually drew them, I wonder? Because they just doing a few little outlines while someone else drew.
They were pretty good.
It was pretty, wasn't it just an outline?
Yeah, I could see the pencil, and then he was tracing over it with darker pen.
Oh, I thought it was really funny because they're kind of doing a play on those court drawings. But it was just...
But they were caricatures and not like realistic.
I thought it was funny, but also I was like, what's going on? It's me most of this episode. This is fun. What's going on?
Oh, one thing. When they do go back to study the scene of the crime. That's that point where they discover the bolt in the wall. There's the chalk outline of the Gallifrey dead body.
In the robe.
In the robe. That is, you know, they were cracking up when they were drawing that.
But I almost missed that the sight was so bad that the doctor shot the wall and didn't shoot anybody.
Right.
I missed that part in there at the beginning. It's like, oh, we were watching for last night. Going, oh, they did find that spot. I forgot about that.
But stasers only affect flesh, not walls.
Is that what they said?
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
it was a very small,
a little small depth. Thing, so it didn't kill
that be,
the wall.
Can that be? Can that be from my shooting or something? It's like, well, it only affects flesh. Like, well, that's a great weapon.
Not for Daleks.
No. Yeah, right. That's why they had such trouble in that war.
All of our weapons are useless.
Inside the camera, they discover the shrunken dead body of the cameraman. The doctor now knows that the master is on Gallifrey, and this is all about settling old scores. Runcible is ordered to take the film footage back to be analyzed, but he is quickly stabbed in the back, and the records disappear. In the control room, the doctor and Engen argue whether the master could exist without any record of him being in the archive. The doctor says to do so would be child's play. He notices the APC control, Amplified Panatronic Computations, a collection of dead Time Lord memories that can help foresee the future. Except it didn't foresee the assassination. The doctor speculates that the master took the forecast out of the machine and beamed it into the doctor. That means the master has access to the APC. They decide that the doctor should telepathically enter the Matrix to find the assassin.
So this is my favorite power of the master in at not at all my favorite, in that he has matter condensation, which he turns people into dolls.
Not actual dolls, even though
I gotta say, though, when the reporter looked into the camera and shrieked, I was like, what is he seeing? Like, I was extremely intrigued.
And then...
Because, well, yeah, of course. Well, the thing is, you guys told me about that.
You took
that.
The toy out of the box.
Its value is zero. Not,
that's why you screamed.
But yeah, thank you guys for telling us about that power of the master, because right away we knew
we saw it
that was the master.
In Terror of the Autons.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a little better.
A real lunch pail kid.
Yes. Because in this one, I think it's a little bit better that it's an actual doll and not like a special effect shot done poorly for the day.
I liked it better having the person shrunk down because it made more sense of what the actual device did.
And I like it that you don't see it as well.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah. That's what I like about this one.
I like the fact they were dolls because it dehumanized them. Like, that would have freaked me out as a kid. Whereas some special effect where a person's just, you know, special effect down to size or whatever would have been like, oh, they did a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But to actually have a physical, like, it looked dead, so that would freak me out.
And it's nice that it's like, you know, what do you do with the body? You put it wherever you can, and here was like a hidden place that nobody thought to look for a body.
Yeah.
I also like in this scene, I like how they didn't draw attention to it, but the mechanics of the recordings in the camera, they built a whole prop. They were like tapes in there, round tapes that he was taking out, and then he had the one that he didn't take. So there was this whole mechanisms that all made sense that made it feel more real, because I thought they were just going to totally pull something out and it was going to be totally fake looking. They were going to hide the fact, but no, they built like a whole thing. I was pretty impressed with it.
I think it's interesting now that we're in this post-internet age, where if this was happening today, you would type into a computer and bring up the video footage, you know, and like they have that technology. They have like databases and these huge like centralized storage, but for media, like, no one even like that wasn't a concept at the time.
But the sci-fi part of it then was that all fits on this one little disc. That's crazy.
Yeah,
there's a joke about that in Captain.
But no, I mean that was a very interesting like section, and seeing how their technology, which was supposed to be, you know, so advanced, but yet they still have to go pick out like a physical medium, where today, like, we've moved so far beyond that. Like, it would be in the cloud somewhere, like the Gallifrey cloud. But back to like the dolls, I think one thing that really, for myself, noticing on this is that, not having grown up with Doctor Who, like, thank you for filling us in on some of those like more cultural aspects of it. Because, like, I did grow up with Star Trek The Next Generation, so now I feel like I have internalized so much of that story that when I see like Star Trek tropes elsewhere, like I can recognize them much quicker.
Such as what?
Such as I don't know examples.
Stasers.
Yeah, or like set phasers to sun, yeah. Beam me up, Scotty, like dilithium crystals, like all that. But like here, not having watched it, like, and not knowing, like, oh, well, the master shrinks people, mm-hmm. you know, but having that background from this podcast and yeah. everybody, like, I was in on that, not joke, but I was in on that reveal mm-hmm. with the Doctor, which was nice for once mm-hmm. with one of these classics.
Yeah, at the time, because I remember the Autons. When he was in the lunch pail, it did look odd having that look. So this did, I agree, look better. But just, you know, having the C hand to hold on to it, I just want a little bit more than that.
But then that goes to Doctor Who making everyday things become scary, like the daffodils or mm-hmm. the phone cord or
right.
mm-hmm. Plastic furniture that's in everybody's house.
And I like to, what did they describe the shrinking as? Like matter?
Matter condensation.
Condensation.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer the laser screwdriver, to be honest. That's why when that came out, right. I was like so thankful.
I believe this is where we learned that the Masters then sent the premonition to the Doctor. So this is like, oh, good. Now it's not just the Doctor you know,
crazy.
He doesn't have some power.
Right. It's just, okay, he received this. You know, because they already said that they are a little telekinetic. You know, telepathy on in this race, so you have a little bit of that.
And so basically, he baited him into coming to Gallifrey.
Think of it like a psychic paper message. That's how I rationalize this. Yeah. This is very early like form of that.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's exactly what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
He's setting a trap. Mm-hmm. And I think he even says that and says the Doctor knows it's a trap, but he can't help himself.
Again, the Doctor's character is consistent that his curiosity is going to override a bunch of these things.
I liked how they did the whole setup, is that these are the Time Lord's minds, and it's more scientific to kind of rationalize and, you know, deduce what will be happening as different ideas or things come to be, rather than being an actual precognitive
thing
like Minority Report, where they needed precogs to do it, they needed certain people to do it. This was just having such a mind conglomeration.
Mm.
Ultimate computer that can then kind of foresee what's going to be happening,
mm-hmm.
you know, just logically.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
Rather than being a spiritual kind of idea or some metaphysical kind of idea, it was a lot more in science based.
All right. I didn't even put that together, but that makes sense because.
Well, that Frank and I come up with these weird out of the way kind of things.
No. I think they did mention that in some regard, but because it didn't happen yet.
But that is missing. That's why they couldn't, you know, foresee the idea that the president would be assassinated. They did foresee it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the master took that
memory. Quieted that alarm or whatever.
Right, that foreseeable event out of that matrix.
And then
sent it to the Doctor.
Okay, yeah. Right. Which meant it was missing from the database. So
right.
Say hello.
That's very helpful. I missed all of that. But I feel like not knowing that, I don't think it took away.
I don't think so.
My enjoyment of this.
No,
episodes are so confusing that sometimes it's hard to follow, but seeing it, it's like explained so much of why the Doctor got this message, why he had to go to, you know, Gallifrey, because he felt like he's being drawn there because the Master is throwing these, you know, little trails to follow.
I have a question. They keep using initials or for something like
DE,
like starting around this point.
That's data extraction. Someone had data extraction from the Doctor's records. So the DE, I think, was data extraction.
It was interesting how much logic and sci-fi were wrapped together for story writing, and this is just a year before Star Wars came out. I mean, obviously, Star Wars was written before 1977, but it's just all of this stuff was just in the air.
Mm-hmm.
The Doctor encounters a series of obstacles in the virtual world. In the real world, the Master sends a guard under his control to kill the Doctor, but Spandrel stops him. The Doctor discovers that the assassin is Chancellor Goth, who tries to drown him.
Wow, that was a quick 22 minutes.
With a name like Goth, you have to be the villain.
Well, I didn't know what his name was. Yeah. I was not tracking that, but I was like, this guy with the gold lips.
So I wonder if the Wachowski brothers have a lawsuit against the BBC. I mean, vice versa.
Yeah.
The BBC has a lawsuit against the Wachowski brothers.
Because of The Matrix?
Yeah.
And actually, later on in the classic Doctor Who, it's called The Matrix.
Well, they...
That's its official name then, not just another name of the Ark thing.
So they plug your... I mean, this is The Matrix.
Yeah.
I don't know if the Wachowskis watched this or not, but it's beat by beat the premise of the Matrix world. Right down to when he tries to start seeing through it, he sees numbers and zeros and things like and equations, and how like he sees his bullet hole go away, but then it's too difficult, so only special people can control what happens in the Matrix and all that.
It wasn't too difficult. It was just he didn't have the power that Goth had.
But the fact that someone can have control over their environment as if it's reality and that it's difficult, and that would make someone very special who can do... Like, it's all the Matrix, the way they're plugged in, that if you die in the Matrix, you die in real life, and I'm watching, I'm like, oh my God, this is kind of beat for beat, concept-wise.
But I also brought back North by Northwest when he's
yes.
running in the field yeah. as a plane is coming to shoot at him. So.
And I thought it was a Psycho... Shore Leave, the episode from Star Trek.
They could have made it a lot quicker. They just put Benny Hill music behind it and just did all these little bits.
They certainly could have.
There's a production reason they did this episode, because a lot of the TV directors shot on video and they wanted to shoot on film. So the easiest way to do that is to go outside.
Why did they want to shoot on film?
Because that was something back then that people wanted to get like under their belt experience.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. I also think BBC likes to do things on the cheap, so that's where they're pushing video.
Right.
Yeah. One thing I did like more is that the running was actual running in this episode, as opposed to a casual jog away from danger in most of the other episodes that are on set.
And most of it was just him.
Yeah.
There's only
impressed.
One actor to pay for a lot of this scene.
The 10-year-old kid in me loved watching him, you know, run around the wilderness.
Mm-hmm. I like the effect of the eyes. Like, I think when
the quarry,
I guess Goth is telling the Doctor that this is his world. I know that's something that is seen in a lot of kind of like ethereal worlds that somebody else is in charge. But I thought it was okay. They did a pretty good job. They kept it like really tight around the eyes themselves.
They had a lot of good ideas for the action in this episode. But like when he puts the poison in the water, you can obviously see it, and then he leaves the bottle. And
don't leave the vial next to something that you've poisoned.
And then, but then I did like the what the Doctor did with the poison dart. Like, I liked all the ideas, but and I found it very like editing wise and shot wise, like ramshackled, ingenious as to like, well, they didn't show the bottom half of him, so his legs could be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was interesting to see how they put it together.
Yes, go ahead and poison the water, but don't litter.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
That's a crime.
It was just kind of like, all right, what do we have in the warehouse that we can grab really quick? All right, this weird egg thing.
Okay. Oh, that egg. I'm like, what is that?
And everything kept happening to his right leg. Did you notice that? His right leg got trapped in the train tracks. Oh, and that train came, even though it was sped up.
So hard.
It did catch me off guard. I was like, oh no.
No, I laughed so hard with that train reveal, because you've got like this tree clearing, right?
Yeah.
And then this little bitty little toy train comes out, and that was supposed to
sure it was at some train museum.
Hit the Doctor, and I just laughed.
That train is actually a mining train. That's why it's smaller.
It
takes the minerals out.
I was expecting a full blown like steam engine train.
Because they showed us some of those, I think, with the guys in
the goggles,
right?
Yeah.
Like, there was some larger equipment.
But those goggles do nothing.
I don't know. I hope it was supposed to be funny, because I laughed.
I just think it was supposed to be weird.
Yeah.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, so his right leg got trapped, his right leg stepped in the egg, his right leg got shot.
It's more photogenic.
It's more photogenic.
Yeah. Right.
It's my good leg.
This is my model leg. The other one, not so much.
I did want him to say, when he saw the World War II officer, are you my mule?
Yeah.
I think that's World War I, that gas mask.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Did I say two?
Yeah.
It's okay.
It's totally World War I.
And then there's the alligator.
Yeah, that doesn't come back.
And then the fake alligator.
Yeah, and then the clown.
They could have gotten any
shit. The clown.
The clown.
And then the samurai.
Yeah.
And then he's on a surgical table for some reason.
The dentist.
Oh, with the big syringe. Yeah.
And then, like Frank mentioned, the plane, which that plane was a model plane.
Yeah, I figured it must have been.
But like a huge model plane.
Yeah.
So they, I was like, that's impressive that they made it look like it was actual biplane coming in. And then they did, the cutaways are of a set with the guy with the gun.
But I thought it was funny how they cut away to a fake alligator when you could have just used stock footage if you're going to cut away to something else.
I think one of like the differences that we have now from like the Matrix as a more modern take on this idea is... like, why was the doctor thirsty? Like, why does he need to drink? Like, especially with the mind over matter kind of stuff.
Well, I think that's the thing, is that it's such a reality.
Yeah.
You can't break it.
And how long was the doctor there?
Right. Like,
that's
it was 5 minutes. For his real body was 5 minutes, but there could have been days.
I think it was 30 minutes. I'm just kidding.
Also, what's
22?
Also, what's frustrating about watching... someone trying to kill someone else in a world that they're controlling, it's just like, why do you even need to poison the water? Just make the water poison.
All the water poisonous.
All the water's poison now because I am in control of this world. And so that was frustrating to watch, probably as a modern viewer who we have experienced in media reality worlds. Yeah. So I'm going to give it the benefit of the doubt and say, like, in the 70s? No.
Oh, yeah.
This was a new concept. It was fun to see these two people battling out in a fake world.
But a lot of times you buy into your own world. Go ahead.
No, just that in 1976, it was such a high concept that kind of overrode. Yes. It was such a high concept that overrode any kind of logic, you know, doubts and stuff like that.
But I think you buy into your own fallacies of things. As well. Mm-hmm. You know, there are times you do something and people go, why you did it this way? You could have just done this. Oh, yeah. Didn't think of it that way. I just got into the habit. Mm-hmm. So I think creating this world, he created a world he could live in and believe and own, and then just didn't go as far as being the total god, because that's not who the Chancellor really was.
Right. Because I was confused at first. Who is that voice? Is it the Master? Is it this other guy who we don't know who it is yet?
Maybe that was my problem.
And then now I was about to say, why couldn't the Master just do that? But he couldn't have, because he needed to be incapacitated in order to do it. So
something that we've done references this episode. When the Doctor, it cuts back to him and Gallifrey on the table of the Matrix table, whatever. Engen says his brain must have an unusually high level of Artron energy. And that's from The Wedding of Sarah Jane, when Clive gets zapped with Artron energy from the TARDIS.
Mm.
So I like that they did the research and they kind of ties back into this.
Another thing that this episode reminds me of is going back to Auburn with the eyes showing up everywhere. It reminded me of the movie, the Doctor Who movie in the 90s, where the Master's eyes just showed up at the beginning, you know, the movie, I guess. Don't want to repeat myself too much, but...
And it's a motif throughout.
So the eyes are really potent, and it's almost... I get confused, you know, same with you, whether or not it was Goth or the Master, and I don't know if the Master is really linked in kind of on a layer of it.
Yeah,
so he's there watching everything and knowing, going, stop doing it this way. This is the way you have to do it. And being so more into it. Because on the other end, you have the Castellan.
Castellan.
Why do we both have a problem
with
that?
I don't know.
I keep going with Castellan. The Castellan is watching, going, oh, look, there's somebody else in the Matrix. He is fighting somebody. It's a fear of flight situation. It's like, he's going to be strong enough to fight it. Who else could be in there? You know, so that was a nice bit when they kept cutting back. So it wasn't the whole episode being the whole chase. I did like the Doctor, no TARDIS, no Sonic, using what the other person created in the needles with the poison to attack. And then also using the marsh gases.
Yeah.
He did it right before, you know, so that when the guy shot at him, it exploded and he got on fire.
I thought that was very
using
clever.
Using everything that the guy's doing against him, since he's not strong enough to create his own reality in this, he's able to use it against the guy. Yeah. So I thought that was great.
What I didn't like is how when the gases caught fire, that still didn't work.
Right.
Like, that
it
seemed like... that seemed like
a little bit of
anyway. It was interesting to see him in a fist fight, I'll say that. Yeah.
Goth did a lot of work because this episode is just the Doctor and Goth. And so Goth was the samurai and he was the clown. And he was the guy...
The same actor?
Yeah, the same actor in also the biplane. Production-wise, it could have been anybody dressed up. But,
no, I know, but the samurai
Who is that actor?
Bernard Horsfell.
Oh, you know, that's it?
So, I'll tell you later.
Oh, okay. It definitely, the difference in film stock to video stock worked in this because it was in The Matrix or whatever. Mm-hmm. It didn't go from like, well, now I walk through this door and everything looks different.
The Doctor escapes from Goth. The Master tries to overload the Matrix with the Doctor and Goth still inside, but the Doctor wakes up. Everyone is shocked to learn about Goth. They find the Master's hideout, which now contains his lifeless, decayed body. Goth, near death himself because of the overload in the APC, explains that he knew he wouldn't be named president. He found the Master and agreed to carry out his fiendish plan, but he dies before saying what that plan was.
Of course. But we do see that the Master had a syringe.
Handy.
Yeah.
I did like the Doctor's response, though. There's no straight answer to a question from a politician.
There's that last, it's in the beginning where the Doctor is running through the quarry and you see the pyrotechnics and explosions. Yeah, explosions. I'm like, those are right by Tom Baker. That's crazy.
And I'm always impressed at how committed Tom Baker is to doing whatever it is he's doing, as weird and crazy as it may be. Like, he gives it 100%.
Yeah, I think when he was first laying down to enter the Matrix, like, I don't know much about Tom Baker, but I knew that he was waiting to give that pained expression of, like, entering it.
I did like that they explained why they moved the TARDIS. At the time, it was, just in case the Doctor comes back, we don't want the TARDIS to be here, but that Goth knew he was already inside, and this is the way to get into the Capitol so they could assassinate the president as a coverage and set him up. So I did like that they explained that's why they moved the TARDIS, that he knew.
Because there was that, when the Doctor went back into the TARDIS, the Master does, oh, Doctor. So it's like, that's how they
so
knew
predictable.
It was. Yeah, so predictable. So it's like, that's how they knew it was there.
I don't like the death rattle of Goth. He's like, Ish. My plan.
Usually those type of things can bug me, but this one didn't.
Yeah, and then this time I'm the opposite of what I normally am, so me and Frank have switched in the Matrix. Cardinal Barusa drops the charges against the Doctor, then creates the new set of facts that will keep the public's faith in the Time Lords. Barusa wants the Doctor off Gallifrey, but first, he wants the Doctor to create a Time Lord record of the Master for the database. Engin and the Doctor discuss the Master's character, and the Doctor starts to believe that he can't be dead. What would the Master want with the President of Gallifrey? The only thing special about the office holder is that he holds the relics of Rassilon. The relics hold the key of the Eye of Harmony, the source of the Time Lord power.
Was this the first mention of Rassilon?
Don't ask questions you don't know the answer to.
I mean, I know the three Doctors.
We selected this for the podcast because of the Doctor being on his own, no companion, the Master, and Gallifrey. These are all things that tie in to the end of time.
Hmm. First mentioned in The Deadly Assassin.
So yes, he is first mentioned. Good one. It had all those connections with the end of the Davis and Tennant run that we thought this was a good pairing.
And during this scene, they talk about, this is where they talk more about the Master has faked his own death before on Tercerus, and that there's no more generations and all that. And the whole idea of changing the narrative so that Goth would be the hero, you know, coming in to battle the Master, and then they both die for that. It's like an interesting way of rewriting history.
I think this is also the first time they mentioned that there are 12 regenerations, and after the 12th one is death.
I think you're right.
And then
we always knew they were as finite, but I don't think that they had like really set
a number. Yeah,
it made me think all the old, you know, all the older characters in this episode, like they're not warriors or anything, so the chances of them dying are slim. So they just live for hundreds and hundreds of years, just doing their own thing, and then they just keep going.
Are you regenerating?
So, so for them to look to be that old in appearance means that they've been around. So I wonder if they get that old each time, which is, like you said, hundreds of thousands of years, because they don't have a high-risk job. Mm-hmm.
They could be on, like, their first or second life.
Yeah.
We don't know. Or their second life. I'm just kidding. Going back to the Eye of Harmony, the sash apparently is that relic, and I never knew that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that comes back in. I don't remember.
The Sash of Rassilon.
Like, because that's the whole thing.
Tied to the Eye of Harmony?
Yeah.
I don't think it does. I mean, he has the Sash, but I don't think they ever, like...
Harmony. It just seems important. Like, the Doctor's worried that the Master has it, and I don't... In my research, I don't remember it coming back into anything.
Yeah, well, but the Eye of Harmony, they mess with anyway, because I am Harmony, you know, it's on Gallifrey, but all these people are like, it's a myth.
And
you've
then
got a black hole on the in your planet.
And then in the movie, it's inside the TARDIS.
Yeah, and it's still in the TARDIS with Matt Smith.
Yeah.
I always thought it was more, Eye of Harmony would be the center part of the octopus, and then all of the tentacles would go out to all the different TARDIS, you know, so that it would be in both places at the same time in space.
Yeah, I can see that.
Reaching out, kind of like that kind of an idea. That's why it's like, that's not just one thing. It's in multiple places at the same time. That's part of the whole mystic part of it.
Yeah. The Eye of Harmony?
Yeah, what's in the TARDIS? The Eye of Harmony is in the TARDIS?
In the TV movie, and then it's in canon for Matt Smith's TARDIS. And that's where the Time Lords get their power. It's like a black hole.
How did...
There's actually a bridge.
Why was it in Matt Smith's TARDIS and not the previous TARDIS's?
Rose as well. Rose took the... She looked into the heart of the TARDIS.
But we... They
but
didn't
that's not the Eye of Harmony.
But they didn't call it the Eye of Harmony.
That was, so that was the same thing, just not called that.
No, because they were... They that was the energy of the Time Vortex kind of a thing. And nobody's supposed to take that all in at once. But the Eye of Harmony is actually a physical thing, where with Matt Smith, there's actually a corridor that turns into a bridge, and you look over and you're looking into space and seeing a black hole.
Why is it there?
The power of the TARDIS.
It depends on the writer, I guess. I don't know. No, we just know it's a power source. But anyway, I just thought that the sash would come back into play, but I don't think it does.
Spandrel orders Hildred to restructure the Master's body and analyzes the serum he used to end his life. Spandrel tells the Doctor that the Master didn't die of natural causes, and the Doctor realizes the serum is a neural inhibitor. The Master is still alive. The Master kills Hildred by action figure death ray.
A ray.
Not actual dolls, even though they are.
And takes Rassilon's sash and rod, goes underneath the panopticon to unlock the Eye of Harmony. This will rejuvenate his decayed body, but will also destroy Gallifrey and 100 other worlds.
I didn't get, while I was watching it, it would rejuvenate his body.
It's easy to miss that.
I just kind of figured,
he's doing it to get his lives.
Oh, okay.
I do like the orders to change the Master's body. So basically, we're going to say that he was shot.
Mm-hmm.
So we need his body to be shot. So he orders the guy to go down and shoot the dead body.
Oh, is that? I didn't catch that.
Yeah, that's what
I wondered why he was
pointing
the gun.
He's telling
him
to change the evidence to match the story.
Oh, yeah,
okay. Restructure.
And yeah, the restructure of the body.
Now you guys have seen these episodes a number of times, right?
Yeah.
So did you catch all this when you?
Not until last.
Not the first time. Yeah. No.
Yeah. Actually, that's what I was going to say.
Because what I'm merely focusing on is that the guy is saying, "Go shoot a dead body. Even you can't miss that."
I didn't even.
Because again, it's another example of his. He thinks the guy's incompetent.
Okay. Right. Well, that's a lot of times why I like rewatching stuff. It's a new experience the more you watch it, because you'll catch things that on first viewing don't have any meaning to you. And then when you watch it again, it has a whole bunch of meaning. So there's actually a lot of substance there that you didn't even realize.
And for the podcast, we always watch with closed captions and you catch a lot.
But I'm sure, yeah.
The Doctor enters the chamber and the two fight. Eventually, the Doctor pushes the Master into a chasm on the floor and closes the Eye of Harmony. The crisis is over, but huge amounts of damage has been done. The Doctor tells Barusa to adjust the truth again and leaves in the TARDIS. At the last moment, Spandrel and Engen see the Master enter another TARDIS, which is camouflaged as a grandfather clock. Will the universe be big enough for both the Doctor and the Master?
I didn't get that.
No, again.
I was like, what's he doing in a clock?
Then you shouldn't watch, I think it's Castrovalva and Legopolis, because the Master does the same thing in the clock.
Well, now I'll know.
Is that his TARDIS?
And a column.
It's his TARDIS.
Because his TARDIS is camouflaged.
Like, as a clock.
Yeah, it's camouflaged as anything.
Well, his chameleon circuit still
works. Yes. Because when we first met him, it was a horse trailer.
Right.
If you remember.
Right.
So,
but why do they let him go?
Because they're not security, they're just data collectors. I don't know.
Not my job.
Yeah. They're like, I don't get paid enough for that.
I'm sure the script said, and the Master gets away before they can do anything. Because they had to fill 22 minutes, that's how.
I did like during the fight, how the Master has the sash on, and the Doctor saying, it won't protect you. It didn't protect the President. He's dead. And he was wearing it at the time.
It's funny, I remember seeing the sash before, and it's because I've seen it on the action figure. And now I know where that's from. The decaying Master with the cloak and the sash.
Oh, not the President? They didn't make an action figure of the President?
They did not.
So I just wish that like ADR would have been nice. I wish they would have just gone back in and had the actor re-record those lines that I couldn't understand.
That's good. Yeah.
But you guys, yeah, the face that Brian is giving me is like they didn't have a budget for that.
Yeah, of course.
Well, and even the technology might not have been there to lay it back in.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Although with the mask, with no moving facial expressions.
But if it's video, they may not have been able to put any, they may have had to have been live.
Right.
Because that's how it is. Doctor Who is shot more theatrically, as far as like a theatrical play, or mm-hmm. theater play.
Yeah.
So they do it live, and then that's it. There's no real post-production, because that's why some of those special effects are a little off, because they're done live.
Oh, I see. So it's kind of like...
Yes, like a mixer.
While the thing is happening on set, the effect is happening in the computer. Oh, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's a little crazy.
So that's why when the special effects are done well, I want to point them out, because it's pretty good for the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know... I mentioned Blair Mowat on our Gallifrey 1 episode, but he talked about that a little bit at this panel as he was going through the different years of the
music?
Main title music, how the whole production was affected. Like, now we're starting to see, he would say, like, now we're starting to see in this series more syncing of sound effects with actions because the technology is catching up where they can do more of those later. And, like, and now this series, now the music is also able to be played back and sunk with things happening on screen better because the technology is mm-hmm. getting better to make that possible.
Something I also found funny is that I think it's Spandrel that says that Shibogans, but that's the term is hooligans.
He uses Shibogans. I wondered what that meant.
Yeah.
For the graffiti?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like so, okay.
I wish we had this to shoot the...
Shibogans.
Yeah, so it's the hooligans who... Okay.
I'm like, okay.
But from TARDIS fandom, describe the new age Time Lord dropouts while attempting the Time Lord Academy. So that word was in here. The Seventh Doctor described them. So it's like they kept it going.
Yeah. The Gallifreyan chapters are the Predonians, and they are the notoriously devious sect, and that's who the Doctor belongs to. They are color-coded scarlet and orange. And then the Arcalians, they wear green, and the Patrexes wear heliotrope.
Heliotrope being, Frank?
A kind of color coming from a plant, which is more of a pink purple.
Those are the ones who looked into the schism and ran.
The Time Lord emblem, which we know is the Seal of Rassilon, was previously used in Revenge of the Cybermen. Robert Murray Leach got this from the Book of Kells, which is a Celtic thing.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And at this time, the 70s, Celtic writing or language wasn't around as much as it is now. And in the Panopticon, they only had a certain amount of extras that were dressed in the robes. So they replicated them the old-fashioned style by just doing like garbage mats.
Hmm.
And then just replicating everybody in the different...
But if all the effects were live, then how did they do that?
Certain things they did, they took time to do.
Wow, now that's...
Yeah, that was pretty impressive.
That's impressive.
Mm-hmm. So what that means is that they held down the camera, shot certain scenes, and then...
Well, they shot the same shot, but the people were over here, then they shot the scene where people were over there. Mm-hmm. Same group of people, they would move them around and then composite it all into one. So five people turned into 15 to 20.
It looked pretty good for the time.
I didn't even notice,
yeah. Yeah, I didn't notice.
And then another shot that I'm just remembering all these things from production stories from the DVD commentary. When the president is coming down, there's that staircase that lowers, but it mm-hmm. couldn't lower all the way. So the next shot is a different staircase, and he's just walking down it.
Oh, the shot where it's coming down? I thought that was a miniature.
Yeah, it's just something else, completely different. So we have Tom Baker as the Fourth Doctor, and then Peter Pratt as the Master. And he was cast because of his voice, because he had to work behind that mask, which... sometimes didn't help.
And what did Tom Baker think about not having a companion?
Oh, did he have an opinion?
Yes, he did.
He has an opinion on everything.
As we mentioned, Elizabeth Sladen left in the previous story, The Hand of Fear. And for two seasons of Tom Baker being with a companion, he said he wanted to do something different with no companion. And they wanted to do a conspiracy theory inspired by JFK and Lee Harvey Oswald. And Tom Baker said, he went up to the producers and said, I can do this on my own. And then they said, but you need somebody to talk to. He's like, I can talk to myself for half an hour.
That's great. And that, he could.
That lines up with stories I've heard of Tom Baker.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
It rings true.
He's probably the most doctor-like of all the actors that have played the Doctor.
Yeah, there's
can't really criticize him. Like
he's not really playing a part. He's playing himself.
Well, that adds another thing about his tenure, because he was there for 7 years. I think they said, like, the last 3 or 4 years, it's just Tom Baker being Tom Baker. You know, like Shatner's playing Shatner in the last movies.
I also wanted to mention that Robert Murray Leach went on to do other production designs, and he was the production designer on A Fish Called Wanda. So good for him. We mentioned Bernard Horsfeld playing Chancellor Goth.
Yeah, he looked familiar to me.
He was previously in other Doctor Who things. He was credited as Time Lord number one in the War Games, so he was another Time Lord.
He's one of the two Time Lords?
Mm-hmm. And
he's the same guy?
He's the taller one, yeah.
Well, I like it. I like that a lot. I mean, seriously, that's a great...
It was Retrocon that he's the same character.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because
that's great. Because, so that's Goth.
Yeah, because originally it's just Time Lord number one, and then he plays a different Time Lord.
Yeah.
But since then...
Talk amongst yourselves. That's great.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, yeah. The other parts that Horsfell has played in Doctor Who were Gulliver in The Mind Robber, Taran in Planet of the Daleks, and then Angus McKay, who plays Barusa. He would later play the headmaster in Marwan Undead, which I don't really like. George Pravda plays Castellan Spandrel, and he previously played Deans in The Enemy of the World and Jaeger in The Mutants. Hugh Walters plays Runcible, and he previously played William Shakespeare in The Chase. And later, he played Vogel in Revelation of the Daleks. But back to Bernard Horsfell, he was in Braveheart and On Her Majesty's Secret Service. So that's... I don't remember.
Braveheart, I would have seen him. I actually still have never seen Your Majesty's Secret Service.
Don't listen to people. It's not as bad as they say.
No, I hear
like,
it's good.
I like it.
I like that.
I like it.
I've been meaning to watch it for a long time.
It's definitely worth it. It deserves to be held high in Bond canon.
It's the one where I can say, yes, this is somebody that Bond truly loves and cares about.
Yes.
Where in Casino Royale, I don't buy it.
No. It's also in Gandhi.
Yes. And then George Pravda also played in another Bond film, Thunderball. He was Kutz, K-U-T-Z-E.
Kutz.
One quick story about Tom Baker's tenure as the Doctor is that when, I think this was airing on Saturdays in Britain at the time.
Yeah, I think it's famously known for airing on Saturdays.
At the height of his time as the Doctor, he was in London when Doctor Who was about to air, and he goes, watch this, I'm going to go somewhere. And he just goes into a random house, knocks on the door. The father goes, like, gives a shocked look, and he's like, may I come in? And he comes in. And he sits down as the kids and the family are watching Doctor Who, and they don't know that he's sitting there. And then when it gets to a slow point in the episode, they turn around, and they just do that look like, that's Tom Baker.
Was he dressed as the Doctor?
No, he was dressed as himself,
okay.
And he was taking, like, let's just say, like, a press tour or something, uh-huh. And he just was in London for a little bit, and he stopped by a random... He just told the driver, just... Drop me off here.
Is he alone?
There was somebody else with him.
Oh, okay.
No, there was no camera with him.
This wasn't on camera?
Mm-mm.
Oh.
The point was to say, I'm Tom Baker. I'm everybody's guest. They're going to let me into their house. I'm that big. And then later on, they did have a photographer because he goes, the kids are going to go back to the school next day.
And no one's going
to
believe
them. And no one's going to believe them. So he had a photographer or somebody with a camera to take pictures, and then he got them free Doctor Who stuff and photographs, so... I think that was really... It's a nice story, a little anecdote from him.
Wow, it's crazy.
It's like Tom Hanks walking up to a wedding photo shoot. Hanks.
Or Bill Murray.
Yeah.
So The Deadly Assassin can be found on DVD and BritBox streaming. I found the commentary on The Deadly Assassin very entertaining. It has Tom Baker, Philip Hinchcliffe, which is the producer, and Bernard Horsfell, who plays Chancellor Goth. Tom Baker is very entertaining, and he's reacting to as if he's watching the episode, like where he gets caught in the train tracks. He's like, watch out, there's a train. And then he gets caught, and he's like, oh, I knew that was going to happen.
When was the commentary done? Like, what decade?
Around the time of season 3's finale, because Tom Baker knew that the Master was going to be played by Derek Jacobi, because he goes, I know this a little bit that I shouldn't tell you, but I'm going to tell you. All right, so final thoughts on Deadly Assassin?
I mean, I spent most of the episode confused, but still entertained, which is never a bad thing when you're watching a television show. And I am a fan of Tom Baker, so I enjoyed his monologues. Like, I always like it when Tom Baker, in pretty much everything he does, he'll do this. He'll be talking, and then his voice will get guttural, but just for a word or two, and then it'll be back. But so yeah, I enjoyed watching it because of Tom Baker's performance.
When all these classic episodes, I would say this is one of my favorites of the classics that we've done, because I feel it's the most competent. I don't see too many of the seams and stuff like that. But once I get past the production limitations, I'm always intrigued. I always find the writing interesting. And even where it is confusing, I just more see it as a sign of the times. But I could totally see why this was something special that has lasted the ages.
This was one that I had trouble getting through. And I did not do a rewatch. Usually I also like to watch things twice just to get more out of it. But the action was fun. I mean, it's not any worse than some of the other classics that we've watched. It's just me personally, I was not able to connect.
This one's one of my favorites of the classics. I really like this episode, but that's with the understanding that anything that's shot on location, I never watch. So I basically watch 3 episodes rather than 4 episodes. And when you do it that way, it moves along fairly fast. It's good pacing. There's a lot of guessing what's going on. I really do like the supporting cast. I like Spindrel. I just like that character. I like the way he bounces off of everybody. And I also like the world building that it does. It really establishes Doctor Who's universe that is still around today.
I like the story a lot. I thought it was well done. But I had a hard time getting through it, too. And I keep getting pulled out of it, but something in it keeps pulling me back in. So you have to just stay with it. And then it does give you enough information about Gallifrey and the Time Lords, which is really nice backstory. And like Brian said, the world building. So I think if you're willing to, like even Josh said, see how they do it differently back in the 70s, give it a shot. It's a pretty good story.
Should we say, just to kind of date this, a number of the top television shows on in 1976 are Laverne and Shirley, Charlie's Angels, Bionic Woman, Happy Days, The Muppet Show, What's Happening. These are all, of course, all American shows. The $6 Million Man, MASH, All in the Family, Sanford and Son. So that's kind of what TV looked like back then. As far as action shows, besides the ones I just... Charlie's Angels and Bionic Woman and $6 Million Man, Barney Miller. Let's see. Holmes and Yo-Yo. Don't know what that is.
Oh, come on. You don't remember Holmes and Yo-Yo?
No, I don't know. I recognize those actors, though.
Oh.
Road of the Gong Show, Bob Newhart. Quincy.
Oh. I know Quincy.
Beretta.
No, Beretta.
Little House on the Prairie. That was a pretty big production.
Not a lot of special effects. Well, there might
have been. Well, it was all period, and it was a big set.
Doctor Who was a half-hour show. I keep forgetting that because now is an hour show. But back then, it was always half-hour.
Hawaii
and
5-0.
Even our half-hour shows, sitcoms, something like that, were done on video. It was only the hour dramas that were done on film.
Mm-hmm.
I had forgotten about that.
That's another thing, too, Starsky and Hutch. So all of the hour shows are on film, and all the half-hour sitcoms were on video. That's ever since I Love Lucy. Alice, Welcome Back, Cotter. God, I watched all these.
I like The Deadly Assassin. We were trying to figure out how to wrap or to pair a classic story arc of Doctor Who with the end of time, which is David Tennant's departure from the series. And I think this the Deadly Assassin has the version of the Time Lords and Gallifrey that stuck. And so I think that is what really cemented this in for me. And the fact that the Master is also involved in a weird state of half decay, half, but then I also can connect it with his half coming back to life with John Sim being in the hoodie and the ravaged state of always eating. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of connections that I was like, yeah, I think the Deadly Assassin will work with the end of the David Tennant specials era. I like the design of Gallifrey, the jade Wizard of Oz Krypton quality, and Tom Baker can do an episode on his own. I would be curious to see what he would have done if he would have done it the way he wanted to do it, as opposed to how the writers wanted to do it. Like him talking to himself rather than bouncing off of these other people that they kind of filled the companion roles with and the other Time Lords. But anyway, you are so inclined, I would recommend the Deadly Assassin on DVD or BritBox. So that wraps up the Deadly Assassin. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time when the future becomes the present.
You've just listened to an episode of Who Knew?
Our wonderful theme music is by Michael Grady.
Find him on Facebook at The Universe Explodes.
All our episodes are engineered by Alburn.
You can also find this show in several places.
Follow us on Twitter at Who Knew Podcast.
Subscribe, review, and listen to us on iTunes and Stitcher.
Or our YouTube channel, youtube.com/WhoKnewPodcast.
Comment on our Facebook page.
Please leave comments, reviews, and click like to help support Who Knew Podcast.
Also listen to us on your Amazon Echo by enabling a podcast skill.
All of our episodes are on whoknewpodcast.com.
This podcast is inspired by Doctor Who,
the longest-running sci-fi show in history.
And especially the revival spearheaded by Russell T. Davis.
Thanks to Russell,
Sidney Newman,
Verity Lambert,
Ron Grainer,
Delia Derbyshire,
and all those involved in the adventures of our favorite Time Lord.
Your work continues to inspire and entertain. I'll bring it up later. Cut that out.
Can you hear that?
Yeah.
I can hear it.
Incoming.
Yeah, right.
It's a doctor falling through the glass ceiling.
Van Nuys Airport.
Let's wait for that. That's loud.
Yeah, it is loud. And a good pitch.
It's that biplane.
From the third episode.